Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording this week's show on Friday, October 29th, which is 2 days before Halloween. It's also Nancy's birthday. As soon as we get done here, Drew, I am baking her a cake. It's a triple chocolate fudge with buttercream icing. Won't be the prettiest cake. The baked goods that I make typically, let's just say if you saw them in the street, you'd step over them, but they taste pretty good.
So this is a cake that you can't eat because you're diabetic.
There is also that aspect, yes. Nancy has a slice of the cake, and then I have to basically drop it into the Tupperware containers, and I run it to her sister down in Pepperell, Massachusetts, and she has nieces and nephews around the area, and I may even take one to my mom. But yeah, it's a look but don't eat cake.
Right.
This is what's so pathetic about when you've been together. Nancy and I have been together 24 years at this point, and she likes to say she turned 39. This is, I want to say, the 25th time she's turned 39. But you run out of things to give at that point. I mean, I literally am reduced to giving her for her birthday a llama planter. But she loves llamas, so it works out. So how long have you and Katie been together?
We have not been together 24 years. Mm-hmm. I think we got together in 2016, mm-hmm. I want to say. So, yeah.
5 years. You're getting a little taste of it. Add another 20. It gets interesting. Okay, while we're recording this edition of Fine Tuning on Friday, October 29th, the podcast will actually go live on Tuesday, November 2nd, which is the 20th anniversary of Pixar's Monsters, Inc. That's when it arrived in theaters, and I thought that Drew and I might talk about that in the second half of today's show, but that will follow the news. News portion of this week's show is brought to you by Storybook Destination, trusted travel partner of the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. For a worry-free travel experience, please book online at storybookdestinations.com. So, looking back at the week in the news for animation, hands down, the big story of the week has to be the teaser trailer for Lightyear, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, this dominated the Twitter conversation for the entire week, I feel like. Even though it's only been out for a couple of days, so.
Yeah, I mean, it
don't ask me how that happened, Jim, but it just did.
Well, you're right. It came out on Wednesday. In fact, given the way the Disney PR machine worked, we're sitting here, and I want to say it was the last half hour of Good Morning America, and suddenly here's Chris Evans introducing the Lightyear trailer there. And then from there, I guess it got pushed out online at 9 o'clock, and that's when the conversation started.
Yeah, I think it also played last night on the ABC premiere of Toy Story 4.
That's right. That's right. In fact, I was watching a little bit of that last night as well.
Mm-hmm. I appreciated that they kept it widescreen. there was no cropping on my beloved Toy Story 4 on ABC. It looked great.
Okay, so just to review here, we talked on last week's show about Turning Red, which is the Pixar film that's going to precede Lightyear into theaters. That comes out in March, and Lightyear comes out in June. Do you want to talk about why Lightyear kind of blew up online? Or?
Yeah, because people are very confused about what Lightyear is, mm-hmm. which I don't really understand, because I think that Pete Docter made it pretty clear at the mm-hmm. Investors Day last year. But people are saying, since the animation was so photoreal, is this sort of like an alternate history version of the Toy Story universe where Andy is living? Because mm-hmm. as we know in Toy Story 2, Stinky Pete said when the rockets went up, nobody wanted to play with cowboy toys, which is also kind of a weird jump in the timeline because Buzz Lightyear appears to be new in 1995. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's sort of the movie that inspired the toy. And I have even found a way to explain Buzz Lightyear of Star Command mm-hmm. in that whole thing, too. So, yeah.
Well, I guess we should also mention, I did a wonderful piece for Rap, like commenting on the fact that, you know, people online came across as confused. It's like, this is a new Toy Story movie, and it's a teaser trailer 8 months out. It did what it was supposed to do. We were all talking about this movie that is coming out in 8 months. And there's the poster of the spacesuit that the Buzz character eventually wears, which is reminiscent of what the toy is in. Did you think it was interesting that, was it the day of or the very next day where Chris Evans himself came online to try to, all right, let me explain what you looked just saw.
Well, I mean, it's sort of his fault to begin with, because he said it's based on the real life man that inspired Buzz Lightyear. Mm-hmm. That was back in December of last year, the same night as the Investors Day announcement. So okay. I think he was both arsonist and firefighter on that one.
That's a great description. Okay. You touched on Buzz Lightyear of Star Command and how you can sort of kind of make this work. We first got introduced to that as a direct-to-video title, right? That came out in August of 2000. And then there was the Buzz Lightyear animated series, which Disney sold to UPN, which I thought was interesting, but it also showed up that very same fall as part of the one Saturday morning lineup on ABC. But what I always found fascinating about that show was it was created by Bob Scully and Mark McCorkle, who the very next time they did something for Disney, that turned out to be Kim Possible, which hit like 2 years later and was such a huge success. And in the tradition of DreamWorks, because they created Kim Possible, this big success, Jeffrey went calling. And they then went to work for DreamWorks Television Animation. And they did the Monsters vs. Aliens series, the Penguins of Madagascar series, and All Hail King Julian. Just recently, Scully and McCorkle returned to the Mouse House and wound up writing Herd on Big Hero 6, the series for Disney XD and Disney Channel. And that show ran for 3 seasons, 66 episodes, just wrapped up in February this year. Buzz Lightyear of Star Command was a show that was produced in that window of time when Disney owned outright whatever Pixar made. So they didn't really have to consult with Pixar when they were doing things like this.
Yes, although they did produce the wraparound segments for the movie
they
version
did.
Of the first
They did, episodes. You know, the direct video. But did you hear that John Lasseter supposedly hated Buzz Lightyear of Star Command?
No, I mean, listen, if we did a news segment on everything that John Lasseter hated, Jim, we would be here for a while. Lilo and Stitch, I mean, yeah.
Okay, there's kind of a point there. Okay, so you're referencing the Investors Conference, and Pete Docter talked about what Lightyear will be. Is the summer blockbuster, supposedly inspired all the Buzz Lightyear toys. In fact, that's the reason supposedly Andy and all of the other boys at his birthday party are so excited when he opens the Buzz Lightyear toy, because they've all seen the movie too. That's why they think this is so cool.
Yes. Although I have a way of folding in the Buzz Lightyear TV show.
Please, please do so.
Which is that as Ghostbusters begat the real Ghostbusters, so did Lightyear beget Buzz Lightyear of Star Command. And maybe the toy is actually based on the show and not the movie, just because the art style is so similar. Oh. But there you go. That's my unified Lightyear theory.
Okay, Jim. Let's watch that bounce around online later today. What do we think of our selection of a director on this thing, Angus MacLean?
I mean, I think he's great. He's been with Pixar forever.
Oh yeah.
And he's done two of my favorite non-movie Toy Story things, which is Small Fry, which expanded the universe a little bit, and Toy Story of Terror, which I hope that you have watched this year, Jim, to get into the Halloween spirit.
To give Angus credit, I mean, how long had the franchise existed at that point? And he was the guy who was able to bend things back to combat Carl.
Yes.
In fact, didn't he get Carl Weathers to do the voice of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now Carl Weathers was in Toy Story 4, so he's added a lot. And also Little Buzz from Small Fry, I think, is one of the funniest Toy Story characters ever.
They were able to introduce the element of delusion again, which had been so much fun out of the very first Toy Story movie. Angus has been at Pixar forever. In fact, was his first credit Jerry's Game?
Oh, it might have been, yeah.
Okay, but he's also done sci-fi. He worked on WALL-E. Not only worked on WALL-E, he directed the short that went out.
Bernie.
There we go, with the Blu-ray and the DVD, November of 2008. Yeah. I liked what I saw of the trailer. It looked like it had the right look. It looked like it had the right feel. Though what was interesting, a lot of Star Trek fans out there were pointing out the homage to Star Trek for the Voyage Home, the flight around the sun.
There's a lot of references.
There's a lot of references.
The cat is very clearly a reference to Ripley's cat in Alien, although this cat's name is Sox, S-O-X, and it's a little robot.
Okay.
Which, it's very interesting. We've had a lot of Pixar cats lately, although we did have Doug Days, so we had some Pixar dogs there, but, yeah, I cannot wait. I thought the trailer was absolutely astounding, so
yeah,
I'm ready for it.
Okay. We were just talking about Robert Scully and Mark McCorkle, who did Kim Possible and Big Hero 6, the series for Disney Television Animation. But you know what other team has done a crazy amount of work for the Mouse House? That's Bill Motz and Bob Roth. Their Disney resumes run all the way back to the early 1990s when Bill and Bob wrote episodes of the original Darkwing Duck. But after that, geez, it's easier to talk about what Motz and Roth didn't write for Disney Television Animation. I mean, they're the writers listed on a bunch of home premieres. I mean, things like Return to Jafar, Beauty and the Beast, Enchanted Christmas, Lion King 2, Simba's Pride. They also wrote the Buzz Lightyear Star Command, The Adventure Begins. Also, Lady and the Tramp 2, Scamp's Adventures, Tarzan and Jane, and Mickey's Twice Upon a Christmas. And in addition to the video premieres, they also wrote episodes of Aladdin the Animated Series, Marsupilami, Quack Pack, Hercules, Buzz Lightyear of Star Command, Disney's Legend of Tarzan, Kim Possible, Brandy and Mr. Whiskers. I had completely forgotten about that show. Plus Emperor's New School and Phineas and Ferb.
This is what happens when Jim spends too much time on IMDb. He just starts listing projects.
The point I'm trying to make here is these are two guys who spent years working on other people's shows and working with characters that other people created. So if anybody has earned a shot at doing their own show with their own characters, it's Bill and Bob. And they recently got that opportunity on the Disney Channel with the October 1st debut of The Ghost and Molly McGee. And you've been thumping the tub for this show for a while.
Yeah, I mean, the animation is so beautiful by our friends at Mercury Filmworks. It's just great. And you finally watched it.
I did. Well, again, it's 2 days out from Halloween, so yeah, let me hang out with a ghost. And so last night, I caught up on the 5 episodes that are available. You were pointing out that these are currently available on Disney Plus, right?
Yes, I think that something like the 10th episode is actually running tomorrow morning on the Disney channels. And I think there's a way of getting them through some apps too. But I really like the idea that they are putting them on Disney Plus early. It used to be that you'd have to wait until the whole season. Now they're kind of dumping them in 5 episode chunks. It's really nice.
Oh, I agree. I love that. I agree. Okay, so a really funny show with some amazing animation, again, from the talented folks of Mercury, but also some really sharp writing. And title characters are Scratch, who is voiced by Dana Schneider of Aqua Teen Hunger Force fame. He voiced Master Shake on that Adult Swim show. The premise is Scratch is this grumpy old ghost who lives up in the attic of this house that Molly McGee's family moves into. And Molly, who's this incredibly optimistic tween girl of Thai and Scottish descent, she's voiced by Ashley Birch, who recently voiced Enid on OK KO, Let's Be Heroes, the Cartoon Network show that my daughter Alice and I really, really loved and still miss. But anyway, Scratch wants Molly and her family to get out of his house, so he curses this little 13-year-old girl. Only the curse somehow backfires, and now he's forced to basically stick by Molly's side. And I think it's a really well-written show. There's a lot of jokes that mom and dad, as they're sitting back on the couch, will enjoy. They've brought in a lot of fun actors to play different roles. I think the last one I watched last night brought in Kelsey Grammer as the voice of Abraham Lincoln. And earlier, they actually brought in the really for real Gerda Gerwig, the director of Lady Bird and Little Women, to play herself. I hope that someone at Disney is smart enough to copyright Gig Pig, the temporary job-finding app that they talk about on the show, because if not, somebody's going to steal that. It's coupled with some really funny songs, and after all those years, Motz and Roth have put in working on with other people's characters and on other people's shows. The effort is clearly paid off. They are now masters of the animated series form and can tell good, solid, funny stories in just 11 minutes. Molly McGee, the show is typically 22 minutes long. It's 2 11-minute episodes per show, but sometimes the 2 episodes tell one continuous story. I think it's episode 3 where they starts off with getting the band shell back together and then the greatest concert ever. But like I said, great show to have been watching around Halloween. But to be honest, The Ghost and Molly Magee would be entertaining any time of year. So please check it out.
And you know what else I saw, Jim, that you ignored on my email, but I'm going to say it anyway. I saw Olaf Presents.
I'm sorry. I was waiting for you to say you'd gotten permission to talk about that.
Yes, I think I can talk about it. It'll be fine. Who listens to the show, really, Jim? That's a threat. That's a threat, and also trying to drum up interest in the show. Yeah. They're 2-minute episodes.
Okay.
They are our good friend of the show, Josh Gad's Olaf, sort of recounting the plot of these movies. And we got to give a shout out to Ava. I think she had some trouble at school this week, so we want to say shout out to Ava.
Okay.
Ava rules. And if anybody bullies her, they're going to have two people to deal with right here.
That's right. I will bring ugly cake. It won't be pretty. So
yes.
All right.
But yeah, it is very, very funny. It's hard, you know, I don't want to give anything away because they're so short and they're so delightful. But any fan of Disney animation or Olaf will really appreciate both the kind of technical wizardry of kind of recycling characters and sets and things from the other movies, and also just the humor that Josh brings to the character and all the wonderful character animation. So I think you will, if you wanted to see Marshmallow play the Cave of Wonders, this is for you.
Oh, no.
Yes.
All right. You had me just him recapping the movies, but now Marshmallow is the Cave of Wonders. I'm there. Yes. Oh, my God. Okay. We were also just a few minutes ago talking about Adult Swim, and you came across the trailer for the 13th season of Squidbillies?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's like one of the longest running Adult Swim shows. Mm-hmm. I think the show is very funny. It's absolutely absurd. And yeah, it's coming next week to Adult Swim, I think on the 12th. So yeah, if we need more Dana Snyder content, there you go. Isn't he on that too?
Didn't he do the grandma or?
Yes.
Okay. You also came across a very brief Wendell and Wilde trailer.
Yeah. So it was this really cool kind of like, it started out as sort of a live video of a boombox playing, and you just see a very, very brief glimpse of Wendell and Wilde, who are voiced by Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Mm-hmm. And Jordan Peele co-wrote this movie with the great Henry Selick, who is directing. And this is his first feature since Coraline in 2009. And I think we've gone over the Shadow King debacle on here before, but it's just good to see some Henry Selick weirdness right before Halloween.
There were 5-6 different clips of work in progress stuff for the Shadow King that kind of bubbled up online. Do you ever look at those? Or
yeah, I mean, they were pretty finished, those scenes. Yeah, it looked really impressive.
It did. I love me some stop motion, so the fact that we're getting anything new from Henry Selick makes me happy. But speaking of stop motion, and I think you mentioned that this documentary was actually out there, but a fine-tuning fan reached out via Twitter to make us aware of Clay Dreams, which I think you pointed out debuted at Tribeca back in June.
Yeah, I mean, things that debut at Tribeca have a hard road to hoe.
Well, especially during the pandemic, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but we would love to see this because it's the story of Will Vinton, right, and his animation studio that gave us the California Raisins, I think, is one that everybody knows.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you're a Disney fan and the five of us who actually went to theaters to see Return to Oz, I mean, the gnomes in, you know, the Gnome King's Lair across the Deadly Desert, I mean, there are kids who are still working that out, went out in therapy. Likewise, those of us who went to theaters to see Vinton's feature, The Adventures of Mark Twain. What I considered so ballsy about that movie is that Will went after both sides of Mark Twain's nature. In fact, after he's lost his wife, Livy, and I'm blanking the name of his other daughter, who I think drowned in a bathtub after they believe she had an episode of epilepsy, Twain went really, really dark. And what's interesting about The Adventures of Mark Twain is that you get both flavors of Mark Twain. You get the guy who wrote the story of Huckleberry Finn and The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, and then the dark Mark Twain who wrote Hadleyville and Captain Stormfield. But both of those are well worth looking at.
You know what my favorite Will Vinton thing was as a kid?
What?
dinosaurs, a fun-filled trip back in time. Do you remember this?
Is this the one that actually features the Ebert and Siskel send-up dinosaurs, or?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right.
I think there's only, like, it's like a 30-minute special, but I think there's, like, 18 minutes of stop motion. But it's very cool. I don't know how you find it now. It's probably on YouTube, but Fred Savage plays a kid who doesn't want to learn about dinosaurs, and then he gets exposed to these crazy dinosaurs. But there's a really fun song. I think that the stop motion stuff was directed by Will Vinton too, so it's okay. It's really, really cool. I really like that a lot, but that was my favorite Will Vinton thing growing up, so I just wanted to throw that out there. As a dinosaur-obsessed kid, there you go.
Something else to chase down on YouTube. But anyway, Clay Dream is directed by Mark Evans, and that's Mark with a Q. And we should definitely try to chase this film down and see if we could get Mark on the show, get him to talk about it. Because he sits down with folks like Bill Plimpton. That alone, you know, animation professionals talking about Will Vinton. I got to say this. But anyway, we were just talking about some of the scarier stuff that Will Vinton did. When Drew and I get back, we'll talk about some monsters. To be specific, Mike and Sully and the 20th anniversary of Monsters, Inc.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
When did Monsters, Inc. first come on your radar?
Well, I was obsessed with Pixar at the time, obviously, and was following this very, very closely. Because I think this was the first movie since Bug's Life, right? Or what was before this? Oh, no, it was Toy Story 2.
Toy Story
2. Was in 99. Yeah. Okay.
But it had been a while.
It had been a while. Yeah, we didn't have anything in 2000. So, yeah, I was very much looking forward to this one. I think there was a trailer on Dinosaur, I want to say, in the summer of 2000. So I was ready, Jim.
This was the one where, isn't it Mike and Sully come into a kid's bedroom and Mike's got the paperwork and there was supposed to be some play on Magnolia and Sully looks at the paper, that's Mongolia. That says Mongolia. And Sully turns around and goes back and hopes that there's still donuts left in the break room. And that's when you just hear the dog growling off. Sometimes the very best teaser trailers don't have anything to do with the movie. That just set up the world and the characters and the way they interacted. That sometimes can backfire. I think I was talking earlier this week when people talk about Lightyear. Do you remember the very first Frozen trailer where it was just Sven and Olaf battling over his carrot nose?
Yes.
And
yes,
the online community immediately fell on Frozen like wolves and, oh, this movie looks stupid and it won't make any money and blah, 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 blah. Then, of course, it makes $1 billion. But even when we got into the really for real trailer for the movie, didn't they also hide that it was a musical?
Yes. I don't think there was any music in any of the marketing materials, which I'm sort of like, yeah, but how do you really put a snippet of a song in there? I mean, I'm sympathetic to that. And obviously, it won people over. It became the biggest animated movie of all time.
So it did.
They knew what they were doing.
Yeah. But anyway, to get back to Monsters, Inc., that first teaser trailer comes out that sort of introduces us to Mike and Sully. And so here's this movie in the fall of 2021 getting ready to be released to theaters. And there's all of this concern because after 9/11, after that, something that was equally scary, there was this spat of envelopes filled with anthrax being sent around.
Which they still haven't, they still aren't totally sure who did that, which is another creepy aspect of it. I think it was a government employee, but
okay.
Everybody was very up in arms about that.
So here's Monsters, Inc. getting ready to be released to theaters. And a big element of that film, of course, is the Child Detection Agency and their hazmat suits. And all over the news are these envelopes being delivered with anthrax. And then you see the footage of the people in their hazmat suits going into places. Didn't one envelope get sent to ABC News?
Yeah. Yeah.
At Disney and Pixar, it's like, do we really want to put out a movie that features the hazmat suits? And in the end, it came right up to the edge, and it's like, oh, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Just put it out there. This is a movie that went through lots of iterations. I got privy to how many iterations because I actually got reached out to by somebody who was suing Pixar because they were claiming they had come up with the original story for Monsters, Inc. Boy. And they wanted me as an expert witness, which tells you how good their chances were in court. You know, it's like, you know who's going to save us? Jim Hill. You know, that's who we want to be associated with. But yeah, I mean, as part of the discovery phase of the trial, I got sent an envelope from the attorney working on this thing. It must have been 2 and 3 inches thick with like 15 different iterations of the storyline for Monsters, Inc. And very early on, the idea here wasn't that Screams powered Monstropolis, but Screams were entertaining, that the folks who lived in Monstropolis would literally, it's 8 o'clock, get in front of the television, and you get to watch the great Barrymore as he goes into children's bedrooms and frightens them. And the shows that delivered the best scares were the ones that got the highest ratings. And by the way, this was sort of modeled after 50s television. The design conceit was sort of like, you know, here's the television industry in the early days when it's still based out in New York. And so here's a janitor who's working at the theater that they do the broadcasts out of, and he wants to break in, and Barrymore is very dismissive of him, and through various machinations, the janitor character goes into the human world and brings a 10-year-old girl back with him. And the two of them conspire that they're going to stage really over-the-top scares, and so the janitor can then become a star as big, if not bigger, than Barrymore. It's an interesting idea, and they spent a couple of years sort of developing it, but they eventually realized that this doesn't quite work, and this is when things kind of mutate to the whole scares for energy thing. But they still keep the kind of the sad sack protagonist. Only he goes from being a janitor to now he's a guy who's working on the loading docks at Monsters Incorporated. And he's so low on the totem pole that he's actually bullied. Do you remember the characters Needleman and Smitty?
Oh, of course, Jim. Well, as a young, pimple-faced man, I identified with them.
He's so amazing. Those two are the ones who are bullying the hero. And at this point, Mike Wazowski is working with Randall. And this is the early version of Mike Wazowski where he doesn't have arms. He just has the 2 feet, but which he doubles his arms. So when you were first paying attention to this movie, Drew, was this when John Cusack was still voicing Sully? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were some pretty regular reports coming out about this was when Pixar did not have quite the lid of secrecy that it does now. And just as, you know, famously Billy Crystal turned down Toy Story, we have another fascinating Pixar casting what if, which, you know, we could do a whole show about people who were actually cast in Pixar movies, which didn't end up being the case. Most recently, I think Elizabeth Banks in Inside Out as Joy.
Yeah, or Bill Macy as
Marlin.
Yeah. And also, I remember going to VES for their Monsters, Inc. presentation, and they showed this earlier sad sack version of Sully and the animation test that they'd done. At this point, he has 4 legs, but they're octopus-like legs. And I mean, they were miles down the road of having built this rig. Again, the notion was he's a monster. He's got to look like a monster. So they were heavily invested in this. You know, he was walking upright with 2 arms, but 4 octopus legs. Did you ever hear the story about how they still kept Boo as like the 10-year-old girl, but in order to add a new wrinkle on the story, she's Gaelic?
No.
So the entire time she's speaking Gaelic to Sully, and he doesn't understand it because monsters only speak English for some reason, and that just seems like it's such a weird row to go down. But they spent a lot of time working on that version of it. And they were married to that one for so long because they loved how the finale was going to play out, that there was this moment where Randall is just beating the crap out of Sully. And you see Boo, and she's terrified. So she runs through the door back into the human world. And you think she's abandoned Sully. And the fight goes on for another 30 seconds or so. And then the door gets thrown open again. And it's Boo with her eight brothers, who are all these hulking brute, and who proceed to beat the crap out of Randall. And they loved that story. They loved that story moment. But it was just one of these things where in the end, it's like, this chunk works, but we can't make the rest of Boo work as a 10-year-old Gaelic girl. And in the end, that's how we wound up with Boo as a toddler, and but still keeping the incomprehensible language thing, because she's a baby and she's only speaks a couple of words or gibberish or that sort of thing.
Right.
The other thing, frankly, the whole notion of Sully is a sad sack. It was one of these things where I remember talking with somebody at Pixar who basically said, we were asking the audience to sympathize with two characters. And that's a big ask. And whereas when you had Boo, you had this little girl, your sympathies automatically went to her because she's away from the human world, she's away from her family. You want to get her back, so you're immediately in her corner. And the beauty of having her as the thing that drove the story was you got to watch Sully go from, oh my God, I'm terrified of the human girl, to coming to care for her, to becoming her protector. And that made you, as an audience member, that put you in Sully's corner. But at the same time, as they're getting, moving through the final stages of production, they kept getting tripped up by stupid things. Like in every single screening of Monsters, Inc. that they did, the moment where Mike and Sully are walking to the factory in the morning and they come up to the corner and there's Godzilla standing there. And here's Sully making small talk with Godzilla. Hank, I think they call him, but I forget how they refer to Godzilla.
Oh, the big, like, chicken guy?
That's it exactly. That it always got this huge laugh in the test screen because you would hear Godzilla's distinctive roar as Sully's making small talk with him. And in the end, you know, in much the same way that the first Toy Story movie, Mattel regretted not giving them the rights to use Barbie in that movie, Toho said, no, Godzilla's, you know, one of our biggest stars. We're not going to give it to you guys for a one knockoff gag thing, which was weird because this is kind of in that same window of time where they're working on Godzilla-based attractions for the park. And it's like, what happened there? You guys were in agreement on the Creature's Choice Award show that Kevin Rafferty was writing for the studios. It's like you couldn't get them to agree as part of that deal to allow Godzilla to roar in Monsters, Inc. But anyway, that gets cut. And so let's talk about the tail end of this movie, which I think this is the first moment where I thought that Pete Docter is a filmmaker I really want to pay attention to for going forward. Because anybody else, when it came to the moment where Sully and Boo reunited, they would have pumped it. They would have had Boo run into Sully's arm and the camera would have whipped around the room and there would have been a big swelling chord and, you know, and that's how the movie would end. And the fact that it's done a little tight close up and, you know, see Sully's nervous face and you have Boo off camera say kitty and you just get that sweet smile on Sully's face and that's how you end the movie. That level of control. That's somebody who trusts his material, that trusts the audience, and it's also the end of City Lights, you know, the Chaplin movie. But, you know, if you're going to steal from the best. But what about you, Drew? If you're looking back on Monsters, Inc., what are your favorite stories associated with this one? Or
well, I'm just fascinated by the design process. You mentioned the version of Sully with the squid legs, mm-hmm. and there was this, for a while, this ethos that the monsters couldn't be men in suits, mm-hmm. like the shape and design of them. You could not put a person in that suit in a live action movie and have it be a monster. Mm-hmm. So that is why, I mean, you look at versions of Mike too, where he doesn't have any arms. Mm-hmm. He's just the orb with the legs and yep. he's you know, reaching out with his legs mm-hmm. and it, you know, it's very odd, and obviously they kind of backed away from that, but, you know, just the sheer amount of design work that went into that and figuring out the world, and, you know, you look at the book, the Art Of book, or you know, at the MoMA, seeing that exhibit and just seeing the amount of drawings they had, and Sully with a top hat, and, you know, it's like, oh my God. And the fact that all of that development too sort of led to Finding Nemo being kind of a low budget Pixar movie because they had spent all this money on Monsters, Inc.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yeah. And then, of course, if you talk with anybody at Pixar, you know, all they'll talk about when it comes to Finding Nemo is, oh, God, the particulate matter. Just to make water look like real water, you know, and the diffusion, right, and the light issues.
And how many bubbles, and
yeah. No, you're right.
I'm just fascinated by that. The movie turned out so well, and I'm actually a big Monsters University fan, too, so I think underrated.
Lesser so, I have to say, though, if you stick the ending, I'm willing to overlook a lot. And Monsters, Inc. has a great ending. It just clicks in nicely with everything we know and has a nice message and all that. Speaking of Monsters-related, you know, follow-ups and that sort of thing, we need to touch base on Monsters at Work, which just ended over at Disney Plus. And by the way, we were just talking about Bob Roth and Bill Motz and Robert Scully and Mark McCorkle. And it's important to point out that Monsters at Work was done by Bob Zganaway, who did, I mean, Disney television animation things like Timon and Pumbaa, the animated series, 101 Dalmatians, the animated series, House of Mouse, Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, Lilo and Stitch, the series. And that's the thing. You know, on the television side, they have this deep, deep bench of people that they're still using for shows that are still doing great stuff. And speaking of a deep bench, let's talk about this week's Light the Fuse. What do you got coming?
Well, this week I think we're wrapping up our conversation with the associate producer of Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation. And then we talked to Chris Peck, who was the prop master for Ghost Protocol and has some amazing stories. And he worked on Tomorrowland with Brad Bird, so he got to work with Sid Mead on both of those projects, which is pretty awesome. And he kind of walks us through all the amazing props from Ghost Protocol. And then we're talking today. As soon as I get off this call, we talked to Anthony Giacchino, Michael's brother, who did the behind-the-scenes footage for Ghost Protocol. And it's sort of part of our big 10th anniversary of Ghost Protocol stuff that is coming out this month and into next month. So, yeah.
That sounds great. Tell you what, folks, if you could do Drew and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and recommend Fine Tuning, but also Drew's terrific Light the Fuse, and you could head over to Bandcamp and subscribe. Drew, could you tell folks how they could find you on social media?
Sure. I am Drew Tailored, like a tailored shirt, on Instagram and Twitter. And yeah, I'm always tweeting about something, and I'm sharing my articles too, so if you have trouble finding those, a lot of discussion about the Runaway Brain article on there.
Deservedly. It was a great piece. And more to the point, the thing you wrote just this week for the wrap about Lightyear is well worth checking out as well. So speaking of social media, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook at Jim Hill Media News. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks for listening, folks. And Drew and I will be back with a brand new episode of Fine Tuning next week. Till then, take care.